This is Renegade Broadcasting.
Everybody, happy Monday. Hope you all had a good weekend. Wow. Weather is really, really starting to get nice. As of Wednesday, we're going to be in the 70s, they're saying. Jesus. The old saying that March comes in like a lion, it goes out like a lamb. No, I don't see any lion at all this month, which is fine by me. Yeah, this is definitely going down on record as one of the most mild winters we ever had. We only had one, it wasn't even a week, but, you know, like 4 or 5 days straight, just a few weeks ago, where we had, you know, sub-zero temperatures. That was it, though. The whole rest of the time, it hovered mostly, you know, around 40. A couple times it was in the 20s, but most of the time when it dropped like that, it didn't even precipitate. So we didn't really get much snow. It was great. Love it. So if that's the result of weather modification, that's they can screw it up that way. It's fine by me. Problem is, though, I don't think it's their intention to give us a mild winter. It's probably the result of them screwing people over elsewhere with majorly frigged up weather. And the implications of it have resulted in warm weather here. You know, how many people have yet to realize that weather modification is a reality? Grand scale weather modification. How many people realize that the goddamn Pentagon has admitted this? It's on their own website. They've been doing it for decades. That's Zbigniew Brzezinski predicted that by 2018, of course, he was off. It happened much sooner than he had predicted, but then he said that governments would be able to use weather modification technology to wage war on their own populations, as well as you know, foreign belligerent governments, without them even realizing it. Even in his day, they were doing weather modification, a much lower technology version of it, you know, cloud seeding. There's a lot of people that aren't even aware of that. And yet that's been going on, you know, since before most of them were born. But, oh, they've got it perfected, you know, down to a frickin' science now. Mr. Cohen, former Clinton's Secretary of Defense, said that we now have a technology that enables us to create and divert storm systems, even to set off earthquakes and volcanic eruptions remotely through ELF waves, extremely low frequency electromagnetic radiation. Yeah, they've been doing this quite some time. He said that back in 1995, folks. Anyway, back to our Jesus bashing. Can't bash this SOB enough, guys. It's amazing how many millions and millions of mindless goy actually praise this thing. And the ones who don't outright praise them still have this fear if they hear someone talking down about him. They have some reverence for him, even though they might not be Christians. They don't go to church. They still would get into a fist fight with you if you dared talk about him in a derogatory way. Are you freaking serious? Check yourself in at a psych ward, please, and make our streets safer. God damn it. It's time to rip the lid off of this thing once and for all. I've had numerous people over the years email me and say, okay, yeah, we got it, the religion thing. Move on to something else. Are you serious? God damn it. We still have at least a quarter of the entire world's population duped by this nonsense. Over a billion people. I'll argue it's probably close to half the population if you add all of the Muslims and then all of the fence straddlers who have some degree of belief in this. Yeah, it's half, maybe more than half of the entire world population duped by this frickin' crap. Get on with it. You know, move on now. Stop talking about it. Are you kidding me? There's not enough people talking about this. That's the problem. It has got to be exposed and re-exposed, trashed and retrashed until hopefully people start to get it and put this thing in the furnace once and for all before it puts us in the furnace again. Just a few short centuries ago, and for well over 15, or well over 1,000 years prior to that, this abominable religion burned at the stake, buried alive, tortured for months on end, years on end for some of them. Anybody who dared question church authority, give them the space, give them the time. They will bring us back to those days. They'll do it again. They'll do it again. The Protestants will do it. Never mind the Catholics, guy. Any of these frickin' religious nuttards, you give them power. This is what they will do every time. Right now, because they don't have power, they're crying victim. Oh, we've been so persecuted. What does that sound like? Or should I say, who does that sound like? Who plays that game? Where did they learn it from? They cry that they're victims of persecution until they get power in their hands, and then they become the persecutors. Oh, they learn from their masters very well, haven't they? They're following their playbook, after all. Throughout most of Christian history, they weren't persecuted, ladies and gentlemen. They were the persecutors. The only time they got persecuted is when people had enough of their crap, rose up against them in retaliation. The same with the tribe that spawned them. Persecution, my arse. The most conservative estimates are 50 million, but it's a hell of a lot more than that, guys. Most scholars now agree at least 150 million people were murdered by Christians, mostly Catholics, only because they had more power. If Protestants had more power, they would have been equaling that number and more. But the Catholic Church has at least 150 million people under their belt, all during the Dark Ages, the mostly through the Inquisition. Some died, you know, in the Crusades. God damn it, man. This religion is indefensible. Protestants love pointing out those Catholic murders. They think it gives them some justification for condemning the Catholic Church and giving them legitimacy. We didn't do that. Oh, you killed plenty of people too, you frickin' nuttard fanatic freaks. Oh, you did it too. And given the opportunity, you would do it again. All you got to do is look at how they lick their chops, lusting after your blood when you expose their cult like what I'm doing now. I have gotten more hate mail over the years, ladies and gentlemen, from Christians than I ever got from Jews. Matter of fact, I don't even remember ever getting hate mail from a Jew. I've had, you know, Jewish callers calling me in and heckling me, and, you know, but I can't honestly say I've ever gotten hate mail from them, but I've gotten tons of hate mail from Christians. They hate you because you're attacking their fantasy world. If, once again, there was any legitimacy to their goddamn religion, do you know what kind of response you would get? Brother or sister, I feel sorry for you. I'm going to pray for you. Jesus loves you, and so do I, and I want you to get into heaven. That's the kind of response you would get. Not, you little bastard, you're going to burn in hell. And then wage this relentless war against you, go onto the blog sites and attack you like little immature children, which is just what they are mentally, aren't they? Of course they are. Little children who believe in fairy tales like talking donkeys and a guy who has superhuman strength unless you cut his hair, or a guy who spends 3 days in the belly of a whale. Yeah, fairy tales like that, or a guy who gets crucified and then rises from the dead a few days later and then goes to heaven in glory land. They don't like it when you expose that they're delusionists, that they're believing in sky fairies.
Click your heels together, Toto, and say there's no place like home.
They want to live in a fantasy world. Oh, we got a lot of people that like to live in fantasy worlds. You know, the UFO crowd. You know, they're a dime a dozen. People that are into Wicca. Oh, Christ. I had a friend that, went hiking one time. And I was saying, oh, I wish I brought my hiking stick. And she picks up a stick in the woods that looked like it was nice. It was very smooth, you know. It didn't have any bark on it. It was just bare wood. But there were no splinters. It looked like it was a piece of driftwood, which is unusual because that's something you usually find near the ocean. You know, we were near a lake. Anyway, it looked like it was sanded down and smoothed over like it was, you know, handmade. I still got it. I kept it. It's really nice. I use it as a backup, you know. Anyway, I remember commenting, wow, it looks like this thing was handmade. And she's like, it was. I'm like, what do you mean? Oh, a fairy left that a few minutes ago for us. Oh, Jesus Christ. God damn Jesus Christ. This woman wasn't religious at all. You know, she recognized the Bible's a fraud, but all she did is replace one ridiculous fairy tale religion with another. Being a Wiccan, she believes in little fairies that appear. Oh, God damn it, man. So, you know, like I was saying, there's all kinds of delusionists out there, people who love to cling to little fantasies, but none of them annoy me. None of them are more obnoxious. None of them are more outright deadly than those who follow this detestable, despicable book of vomit-inducing nonsense. Not only was Jesus not God, you can prove that from the pages of their own goddamn book. Doesn't even teach that. Not only was he not God, not only was he a mere human being, but he was a monstrously corrupt, scoundrelous piece of frickin' freshly dumped, still steaming horse crap. Yes, he was. We're going to be proving that right from the pages of that book. It's been there all along. But again, people love to read things the way they've been told to read them. They like to view the world the way they've been told to view it. My favorite illustration, I got to mention it again. People, I like, most people like those in that story I tell of people gathered around in a field looking at this brown steaming pile. And one guy in the group has them convinced that they're looking at a cute little fly farm. Oh, isn't that cute? Somebody made a little fly farm. And so everybody chimes in because now that's the popular way of viewing it. And even if anybody has any question about it, well, I'm not going to stand out like a sore thumb and be a heretic. So I'm just going to go along with everybody else. And, yeah, it's a fly farm. Only one person in the group has the testicular fortitude enough to call it what it is. Guys, are you freaking daft? This isn't a cute fly farm. This is a steaming pile of horse crap. Somebody pick it up and get rid of it.
What are you talking about? It's a fly farm. It's really cool looking.
That's the world we live in, folks. Everybody thinks they're looking at a fly farm. And you can't tell 99.9% of them otherwise. You can't tell them they're looking at a piece of crap. They love the fly farm analogy, and that's what they're going to stick with. We've been sold so many frickin' lies. And I'll tell you now, religion is one of the biggest. I'll argue it's the biggest. It is the worst. Until you see this Jesus character for what he is, you will forever be a slave to this, or at least a potential one. If not today, somewhere down the line, this crap is going to suck you in. You have got to realize the abomination that it is. You've got to come to that realization. Hate it enough to where you can actually say that Jesus was a scumbag. He was, guys. We ended off Friday's show quoting from him, where he says, I was sent only for the lost sheep of the house of Israel. How could you possibly,
as a goyim,
as a Gentile, how could you possibly think that this religion has anything for you when he made a statement like that? He didn't even have to make a statement. You should already be able to see that this religion is nothing but warmed over Judaism. But when he makes statements like that, and you still think that somehow, God damn it, people are daft. I came only for the lost sheep of the house of Israel. There you go. You would think it would be over right there. That's it. Yeah. Oh my God. I didn't know he made that statement. Hey, this sucks. I got to give up my religion. I've been part of this for so many years, but no, I can't. No, I can't embrace that anymore. No, you think that would be it. And God damn it, that's not all. There's many, many, many more problems, many of which we'll be looking at in this current discussion. But just that alone, you think would do it. Nope. They sweep it right under the rug, along with that other massive pile of crap that they swept under there. Anyway, just with statements like that alone, isn't it clear that the great Jesus's priority was indeed, in fact, his whole focus was indeed Israel, and Israel alone. He was for its exaltation, guys. That was his priority, just like all the other first century messianic claimants. The exaltation of Jewville. That's it. That's all he cared about. Everything else be damned. Remember when he said, Israel will be trodden underfoot by the Gentiles until the time of the Gentiles be fulfilled. He was looking forward to a time when again his tribe would rise up and crush beneath their feet everyone and everything. Look where we're at today, guys. The whole world is enslaved to insurmountable debt to these scoundrels. They have our politicians in their pocket, baby. whether some of them like it or not, and clearly most of them don't care because their pockets are getting stuffed with fat wads of phony frickin' green pieces of paper. They don't care about selling everybody else out as long as they're living cozy and cushy. Little do they know or even seem to care that sooner or later it's going to come home to roost for them, too. They're going to have their little world crash down on their heads, too. Their little masters are going to turn on them one of these days. They don't care. They don't think about that. They're just looking at the here and now, what it's bringing for them. They don't care about selling out the entire frickin' planet to these scoundrels. But the great Jesus was all for that. Don't forget the verses I read last week. I will bring all nations before you. They will bow before you and lick the dust from the soles of your feet. You shall rule over all the nations, but they shall not rule over you. Jesus was all for that. Those verses specifically come from the book of Isaiah. Jesus loved the book of Isaiah. Remember, he read from it in the temple, as we see in Luke 4. He loved the book of Isaiah. Obviously, he loved those passages. That's why he said, I came only for the lost sheep of Israel. Israel will be trodden by the Gentiles until the time of Israel is fulfilled. He wanted the glorification of goddamn Israel. Why do you think he was opposed to the Pharisees? He wanted to bring back the glorious days of Moses where Israel would rise up against Rome and not only not be ruled by Rome anymore, but become the ruler itself. That's what he wanted. That's what all these frickin' messianic claimants wanted from the first century. And indeed, all the ensuing centuries thereafter. There were other messianic claimants. I did a whole show on that one time. All the messianic claimants down through the centuries. All of them wanted the glorification of Jewville. That's what the Essenes wanted. That's what the Zealots wanted. That's what the Sicarii wanted. You make Jesus into a hero when he was a scoundrel, like all of these first century goddamn terrorist insurrectionists. That's all he was. In his day, Christ simply wanted control of Israel to be taken from the Pharisees, or else for the Pharisees to reform themselves, one or the other. If we can't reform you, we're going to take you down. One way or the other, we're going to bring Israel back to the old glory days of Moses. Unreal, man. Anyway, later, as we'll see, it appears that Christ's desire to ultimately take on Rome as well. Initially, what he wanted was to bring the Pharisees around. When he saw that that couldn't be done, he realized, okay, we'll just go right for the jugular. He had aspirations of actually taking down Rome and figured if we can take Rome down, the Pharisees, by default, will fall into our hands. They'll be afraid of us if we conquered Rome, you know, if we kicked Rome out. And when I say take down Rome, I mean just, you know, get them out of the Middle East. That would be step one. And, you know, and then if the Pharisees saw that, wow, they were able to stave off the Romans, you know, then it would be their hope from there to actually march into Rome to gather together all of the, you know, the scattered tribes from abroad and simultaneously have them march on Rome and take over Rome. Some people say, oh, that's not true. They, you know, the tribes didn't scatter. Oh, there's some truth to it. You can see where they did scatter. There was a big settlement in Spain. That's what became the Sephardim later. Yes. That's why Jesus went on that Gadara journey. I did a whole show on that a while back. Most people think he was in the, he was on the Sea of Galilee. No, he wasn't. No, he wasn't. They sailed across the Mediterranean and headed to Spain, ladies and gentlemen. And why? It never tells you what the whole purpose of that journey was, but it's obvious what it was. He was going there in hopes of recruiting them and bringing them back for his little insurrection he was planning. He wanted to recruit all of these dispersed tribe members. They needed the numbers. It was only later when they realized they couldn't get the numbers they needed from within the tribe. That's when they turned Christianity into a goy religion, a Gentile religion, because they needed Gentile recruits. They needed more numbers. We'll sucker them and hopefully be able to use them in the future, whether they realize it or not, to use them to help our cause. That was their intent. Anyway, going back to the time of Moses, all the tribe has ever done was to steal land through brutal guerrilla warfare, employing, you know, the Nubians, for example, to do their fighting for them. Christ obviously was not opposed to this policy since he favored Moses. That's all Moses ever did. Just look what he said in Matthew 23:1-3. The teachers of the law and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat. Imagine that. Jesus went on to say, because they sit in Moses' seat, do as they say, not as they do. In other words, he's saying that the Pharisees were a bunch of hypocrites, don't follow their example, but do what they say. He was still claiming that they had authority. That's like the numbskulls today who say, well, I don't like the president. Yeah, it's probably true. He is a traitor, but he's still our president. We got to do what he says. Oh, really? You just admitted he's a corrupt, scoundrelous piece of frickin' dog drizzle, dog anal drizzle, and now you're telling us that we should follow what he says. Even though he's a scoundrel, we got to go fight his phony wars for him. Oh, give me a break. Get your head out of your ass. That's what the great Jesus was advocating here with Moses. Or, with telling people to follow the Pharisees. He called them scoundrels. He called them vipers, you know, whatever. Hypocrites. Generation of vipers, blah, blah, blah. But yet he turns around and says, do what they say because they sit in Moses' seat. Moses was the highest authority for Jesus. Who was Moses, ladies and gentlemen? He was a mass freaking murderer. And he was a goddamn grand scale thief, wasn't he? Every city that he raided, that he ordered his tribe, in conjunction with the Nubians who did most of the fighting for them. But, you know, the cities that he commanded to be raided, what did they do? They looted them, killed everybody, except on occasion they take some of the virgins for their booty, steal everything, kill everybody, and then burn the city to the ground, move on to the next one and do the same thing. Jesus was in favor of Moses. Hello? Anybody home? Hello? You Bible dupes out there, you mindless goddamn idiots, you praise this thing, you worship this thing, and look what he emulated. I could end the show right now. There's no need to elaborate any further. He upheld Moses, the grand theft, mass murdering bastard. That tells you what kind of philosophy he had. Schmuck. Short break, guys. Be right back.
We'll be right back. If you enjoy listening to Renegade Broadcasting, but are not also reading Renegade Tribune, you're missing out. We have some of the most insightful and hard-hitting authors from the past and present, covering some of the most taboo and controversial subjects. The Tribune is something you'll want to check out every single day. Perhaps you have what it takes to be an author. Sign up and submit your piece. Join us at RenegadeTribune.com.
Bible dupes, of course, in defense of their human God, Jesus, would say, oh, he was all for peace. Didn't he say, blessed are the peacemakers, blah, 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 blah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's in there, all right. But he said it either because he wanted to cloak his war-waging aims, or it was simply added in later, like so many other things were, to make him look good. But he also said, I came not to bring peace, but a sword, didn't he? Once again, do you see how this book is written? So there's something in there for everybody. It is such a contradictory collection of frickin' nonsense. It's a frickin' schizophrenic book with a schizophrenic message, obviously, for schizophrenic people. You have to be schizophrenic to accept, believe in, and follow this book because its message is totally schizophrenic. You got to have a frickin' few screws loose to follow this crap. You do. Obviously, I did a few years ago when I was still believing this slop. I had a few screws loose. I needed a frickin' neurological tune-up. Oh, boy. Thank heavens I got it. I saw the light. I'll never be fooled by it again. You know, when I was a teenager, which often happens, you know, kids that are raised in Bible land. I got away from the damn thing, got into, you know, partying, drinking, getting high, whatever, blah, blah, blah. But guys, I came back to the goddamn thing, didn't I? I came back. Even though, oh, I can remember at parties for a joke, you know, I was such a rebel. I was so fed up with, you know, religion at that point because I felt it held me back and prevented me from having a good time, you know, whatever. I wanted to become the very opposite of what I was, you know. So I remember one time I was at a party and I found an old Bible at a friend's house. You know, they didn't care about it. I asked them, you know. They were having just as much fun as me. You know, we were quoting from it, just making fun of it. I pulled a cigarette out and I burned a hole in one of the pages. That even astonished some of them. They didn't mind making fun of the passages, but burning a hole in it to them, that was sacrilege. I wanted to do that, though. You know, I wanted to go as far away from it as I could. And I remember holding it up and saying, well, this book is sure holy now. You know, I burnt a hole with my cigarette. And they're all, you know, they had to laugh at that. But they still thought I was crazy. Oh, you went a little too far with that one, you know. I completely left it. I became the antithesis of you know, what I once was. But you know what, guys? Didn't matter, did it? A few years later, I was back into it again. It's not enough to call it a piece of crap, to make fun of it. You have got to realize why it's a piece of crap. You need to study it enough to see that it is actually freaking evil. Or you will be sucked back into it again somewhere down the line. I left it the first time for the wrong reason. Now I left it for the right reason. There's no going back, baby. Thank heavens there's no going back. You'd have to lobotomize me to get me to ever accept that crap again. And even then, I wouldn't accept it. You'd have to wheel me as a vegetable into the damn thing. Drooling all over myself. That's the only way you would get any resistance from me, not get any resistance from me. It's absolute mindless frickin' garbage, ladies and gentlemen. Once again, I can't stress it enough. We're going to get into this in a lot more detail. We're going to look at some very interesting quotes from the great Jesus to see that he wasn't the great bastion of truth and peace and love that so many dupes think that he is, was. But already with what we've looked at, the fact that he so warmly embraced the mass murdering Moses, that should tell you something right there. That's what he was all about.
Oh, no, he was good. He was against the corruption of the Pharisees. They weren't following Moses.
That's true. They weren't. And that made them a tad bit better than Jesus with his philosophy, didn't it? They didn't want to bring back the militant days of Moses. They were content with what they had. They realized the Romans weren't being oppressive to them. Why stand against them? Hell, it's just going to get a lot of us killed unnecessarily anyway. The Pharisees in this debate made more sense than the great Jesus, didn't they? But yet they got Jesus out to be the good guy. The Pharisees were evil for wanting to kill him. Can you blame him for wanting to kill him? He was a goddamn insufferable Freakin'rectionist. Of course they wanted to kill him. He was bringing, as were all the other goddamn insurrectionist messianic claimants of that era, he was bringing unnecessary trouble on their heads at the hands of the Romans. They didn't want that. They were the true princes of peace. Jesus didn't want peace. His idea of peace was, we'll crush out all opposition. That's the version of peace today, isn't it, that our government fills us with? They talk peace, but what do they bring us? Wars constantly, right? Because they want to crush out all their competition, so there's no more opposition. That's when there's peace. We've killed everybody who could stand in our way. That's the peace Jesus was talking about, which is, again, why he said, I came not to bring peace, but a sword. The peace he was talking about is, let's rise up like the good old days of Moses and crush out all our enemies. He praised Moses. Need I say any more? I rest my goddamn case right there. Like I said, I could end this discussion right now. I've already made my point. You can't argue it. It's over. Oh, but don't worry. There's a hell of a lot more to come. But I've already proven my case. Jesus was an insurrectionist, goddammit. That's all he was. You mindless drones out there are worshiping a first century freaking terrorist. How does that grab you? You and your hypocritical, finger-pointy, judgmental freaking crap. Shut up your arse. Goddamn mindless fools is what you are. Idiots. I came not to bring peace, but a sword. He said it himself. To understand why it's so troubling for Christ to have endorsed Moses, let's look at a few classic passages that more than adequately demonstrate what a tyrant he really was. Let's look at one anyway. We could cite a million of them, but just look at this one here, for example. Exodus 32, 26 to 29. I've read this on numerous occasions in the past, but it's so fitting again now. Let's take a look at it. Moses stood at the entrance to the camp and shouted, the camp of Israelites who recently had fled Egypt, i.e. were thrown out of Egypt. He stood at the edge of the camp and shouted, all of you who are on the Lord's side, come over here and join me. And all the Levites came. He told them, this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. Strap on your swords. Go back and forth from one end of the camp to the other, killing even your brothers, friends, and neighbors. Nice guy, that Moses. The Levites obeyed Moses, and about 3,000 people died that day. Oh, hooray! Then Moses told the Levites, "Today you have been ordained for the service of the Lord, for you obeyed him, even though it meant killing your own sons and brothers. Because of this, he will now give you a great blessing." This is what Jesus stood for. This is the Moses that Jesus loved and praised. You cannot get around it, you mindless Bible dupes. You cannot get around it. Your Jesus loved this warmongering, land-stealing, money-grubbing scoundrel who said it's okay to charge usury to Gentiles, but not your fellow Jew. It's okay to enslave Gentiles, but not your fellow Jew. It's okay to sell roadkill, or as he put it, animals who die of themselves, to Gentiles, but not to your fellow Jew. This is the man Jesus upheld on a pedestal, praised, and commended his followers to follow. These are the glory days that Jesus wanted to bring back. Oh, wasn't he so right in standing up against the scribes and Pharisees? They didn't want to bring back these days, but Jesus did. Yes, you should support Jesus, because he wanted to bring back the glory days of the mass murdering Moses. Rah, rah, freaking rah. Hooray for Jesus. 10 points for the Jesus team. My God. Call me up, Bible dupes. Call me up, frickin' Jesus worshipers, call me up and tell me how wrong I am. Will you please? I'd love to hear from you. I'm sure a lot of my listeners would too. Let's hear you defend your wonderful religion. You see why they get angry, guys? Do you see why they get angry with people like me? Because they know goddamn well deep down inside that they're defeated. They know this religion can't stand up. This is why they only, for the most part, Christians only associate with other Christians. The only time you'll see them have any contact with non-Christians is if they think they can sucker them in and recruit new dupes who can drop money in the plate every week. But if they realize that they're never going to turn you around, they'll have nothing to do with you. Especially if they realize that you have studied their holy book enough that you can expose it for the fraud that it is. Oh, Christ, they'll never have... Not only will they have nothing to do with you, they'll blast you with thunderbolts. They'll attack you. They'll demonize you. That proves right there the fallacy of their religion, doesn't it? You don't have to open that book up and look at the problems of it and expose it from that angle. You can expose the fallacy of it just by looking at how they act. Once again, if there was any truth to their goddamn religion, their so-called Holy Spirit, whatever the frig that's supposed to be, would convict their hearts and fill them with love for you. Oh, brother, I feel sorry for you. I'm still going to be your friend, hoping one day my influence on you will turn you around and save your soul from hell. Oh, no, no, no. They got you condemned to hell already. And if it was legal, they'd take stones up and frickin' stone you to death. They bash your goddamn skull, and that's how much full of love they are. They're not full of love, ladies and gentlemen. Not at all. Quite to the contrary. They're filled with hate. Like I said, there's a few, and I do mean a few, exceptions to the rule. There are some that are sincere. And, you know, I hate to bash this bitchin' thing for that reason, just because there are some sincere ones. I know a few. Very nice people. Not because of their religion. They just happen to be nice people who got caught up in this nonsense. But guys, most of them, they're not nice. They're not nice at all. They're actually hateful bitches and bastards. I'd rather live next door to a drunk. Drunks, very often, are actually very nice people. And they don't phonily profess to be nice. They just are nice. Anyway, in John 1:18, John the Baptist said that no man has ever seen God at any time or heard his voice. Thus, biblically speaking, it was Christ, the Word of God, doing this talking in the Old Testament, giving this psychopathic command that we just read from the book of Exodus, telling Moses, you know, to go back and forth into the camp, kill everything that breathes. And then it says, 3,000 men died that day. Moses says here that it was God that told him, but according to what we read in John 1:18, for you Christian dupes out there, it wasn't God himself. It couldn't have been. No man has ever seen God at any time or heard his voice, says John. Jesus makes a statement similar to that, too. No man has ever seen the Father. It is the Son who has declared him. So according to Jesus and according to John, and indeed according to Paul, too, Paul says that Jesus was that great rock in the desert, that led the Israelites, that it wasn't God himself. It was Jesus, in his pre-incarnate existence. Yeah, whatever. But my point is, for those who believe the New Testament, it wasn't even Yah. It wasn't the great Yahweh who said these things to Moses. It was Jesus. No man has ever even heard God at any time or seen him. So who was it telling Moses that he was to go and kill all of the rebels in the camp that helped make the golden calf? Who was it that told him to do it? According to the New Testament, it was Jesus. Jesus was the one who commanded Moses. No wonder Jesus loved Moses so much and wanted to bring back the old glory days of Moses. That was supposed to have been him giving that command. Of course Jesus was in favor of passages like that. Go back and forth throughout the camp and kill even your own sons, neighbors, and friends. Jesus was all for that. And if his mission had succeeded the way he had originally hoped, he would have had his followers killing everybody that didn't accept him as king. That's what he told them, right, later on, when he told this little parable about a man of noble birth who went into a far country to establish a kingdom for himself and then to return back home. He's talking about himself, right? Later, he has that same individual depicted as saying, go and gather those who won't accept me as king and bring them before me and kill them in front of me. God freaking damn it. Of course Jesus favored Moses who went through the camp. Of course he commanded or had the same spirit as that voice that allegedly commanded Moses to kill everybody, friends and neighbors and brothers. Jesus told his disciples to do the same goddamn thing. He was all for killing. You don't want to accept me as king? I'm going to kill you. We're told one day when he comes back again. Oh, yeah, when's that going to happen? We're over 2,000 years now into this thing. Yeah, any day now. Any day he's coming now. Oh, get a frickin' clue. Stupid asses. But we're told that when he comes again one day, he's going to come with a sword, isn't he? He's going to kill everybody who wouldn't accept him as king and bow and lick the feet of his chosen ones into endless perpetuity. That's all he's for, you mindless asses out there. You're worshiping a Jewish supremacist extraordinaire. We're told in the book of Hebrews that Jesus is the same yesterday, today, and forever. Well, yesterday would refer to him back in Old Testament times, right? We're supposed to believe that that was him commanding Moses. No one ever heard God's voice. That was Jesus thundering his voice back then, according to the New Testament. And since we're told that he's the same yesterday, today, and forever, then that same tyrannical Jesus that commanded Moses to murder back then is the same Jesus now. isn't it? We're told that he's going to come with a sword and wipe out everybody that didn't kiss his arse. That's what you worship? That's what you emulate, you Jesus freaks out there. You worship a murderer. You worship a thief. You worship a tyrant. You worship a Jewish supremacist. Anyway, how about when Christ chased the money changers out of the temple? Was this act in character with one who was supposed to have been loving and humble? I am meek and lowly in heart, said the great Jesus. We find this account in John 2:15 where it says, so he made a whip out of cords and drove all from the temple area, both sheep and cattle. He scattered the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. What happened to the gentle Jesus here? Paul said that, you know, anger is one of the works of the flesh, right? He called wrath sin that was going to keep people out of heaven. And yet here was the great Jesus displaying wrath in flying freaking colors. If he was the great Jesus that had all the power of heaven at his disposal, right? All he had to do is wave his hand and a great wind could have blown them out of there. As he lovingly said, oh, my dear children, you shouldn't be doing this, you naughty, naughty boys and girls. You have to leave the house of God and don't return. Okay, thank you very much. Or a swarm of bees could have come in and without having to sting anybody, just scared them and driven them out, right? No, Jesus threw a temper tantrum. He displayed anger, which according to Paul is a no-no. Don't you love the exceptionalism? Jesus can throw a raging frickin' temper tantrum and that's okay, but don't you do it, you're going to hell. Yah-Yah can command killing and command you to kill, in which case that makes it okay. But if you kill any other time other than that, it's evil. You're a bad boy. But if the great Yahya commands it, that makes it okay. Murdering little babies is a heinous crime. But if Yahweh commands you to do it, it's okay in Bible land. Bible dupes say baby killing is a-okay when Yahweh says so. You got to love the Yahwehian exceptionalism. You got to love it. You hypocritical frickin' phonies. How about when Jesus cursed the fig tree as an object lesson of what will happen to Israel, instantly killing the tree? We find this in Matthew 5:29. I think it's Matthew 22 or something. I thought I cited it here, but no, this is another passage we'll look at in a minute. But, you know, in that story, Jesus is making the point that what he's really telling his disciples is because we can't turn the Pharisees around. We can't bring them to our way of thinking and get them to rise up against the Romans like Moses would have done. Their house is left unto them desolate. In other words, our tactic now, Jesus didn't tell them this, but that was what the tactic was. We're going to turn them over to the Romans. And then we're going to infiltrate Rome, you know, right from within. And that's just what they did, isn't it? Through Josephus and his little buddies that were taken up to Rome later. But supposedly, at that time, it was a fig tree. He touched it, and he cursed it, it says. And the tree withered right there before their eyes. The fruit dried up. And he said, no more will any fruit grow on thee. That was supposed to be an analogy for the scribes and Pharisees. You know, you blew it, so now you're going to be like this tree. You're cursed. You're not going to bear any more good fruit. You're going to wither away and die, i.e. the Romans are going to come in and destroy you. That was the philosophy of the zealots. That was the philosophy of the Sicarii. That was the philosophy of the frickin' Qumran sects, you know, the Essenes. And that was the Jesus philosophy. We can't bring you over to our way of thinking. We're going to screw you good. We're going to betray you into the hands of the Romans. This is what Jesus was for, and you support this bastard? You mindless Bible dupes out there. Then there's this gem from Matthew 5:29. Christ made another bizarre statement. Oh, he made a lot of bizarre statements, but you got to love this one. If your right eye causes you to sin, gouge it out and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. What kind of outrage? And, you know, Bible dupes will try to defend this. Oh, he was speaking metaphorically. Well, it doesn't really matter now, does it? The little bastard didn't go on to clarify that, did he? He didn't say he was speaking metaphorically. Do you know there have been people down through the centuries who have done just that? People who have cut their gonads off because Jesus says it's good for the kingdom's sake to become a eunuch. But he who can receive it, let him do so. There have been people who have done just that. There have been people and still are people. You hear about them every so often in the news down in frickin' Mississippi, Tennessee, nutbag fanatic fruitcakes who play with deadly snakes and scorpions. And on occasion, yes, they get bit and they die. There was a minister just a few years ago, again, that died. Because the great Jesus said, you will play with scorpions and deadly snakes and they will not harm you. Oh, the filth that has come from following this goddamn book of nonsense. Don't even say they're misunderstanding the great Jesus. He freaking said it. I can't blame people for doing that kind of nonsense. That stuff is in there. When you have over-the-top ridiculous statements like that, how can you not expect over-the-top ridiculous actions? Look at the over-the-top ridiculous nonsense you believe. Oh, you might not play with deadly snakes, but you believe in talking donkeys, you jackasses. Look what this book makes out of you. It makes you into a frickin' idiotic goddamn monkey. I think monkeys have more common sense than a lot of people that follow this nonsense. All right, guys, on a short break, right back.
Constantly thinking naughty, hateful thoughts about the Jews? Do you find yourself actually wishing the gas chambers were real? Do you hate the sight of a yarmulke because it reminds you of the parasitic race that has their greedy little hands in just about everything? Well, then we have got something for you. Ask your doctor about Anti-Semitox. Anti-Semitox is a long-acting injectable lobotomy that assures you will never think those anti-Semitic thoughts ever again. May cause suicide, depersonalization, thoughts of ripping off your skin, your dick may fall off, and you may become infertile. I made the switch to Anti-Semitox. Now I don't even care if I'm a goyim slave. Thanks, Jews!
In the dark, it's raining in the park, but meantime, sound of the river, you stop and you hold everything. A band is blowing Dixie, double fall time. You feel alright when you hear the music ring. Well, now you step inside. In other places, but the horns they blow in that sound.
Way on down.
This is Renegade Broadcasting.
Alright guys, welcome back. Here's another fanatic nut job statement from the great Jesus, John 6:53. I tell you the truth, unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you have no life in you. He's talking about himself here, you know, the Son of Man. Again, Bible dupes would argue,
oh, he's speaking metaphorically, hypothetically.
It doesn't matter. Look at the crap that spewed from his mouth, ladies and gentlemen. This next one, again, they'll argue is hypothetical, but yet at the same time, guys, look at the terminology he's using here. It's like subtly he's trying to whip them into a frenzy to get them aroused, to rise up. Listen to this one, Matthew 11:12. Jesus said, from the days of John the Baptist until now, the kingdom of heaven has suffered violence and men of violence take it by force. How many times did Jesus say the kingdom of heaven is now, it's at hand? He was filling them with the idea that even though he talked about heaven being in the future, I'm going to come to get you on, you know, on resurrection day, blah, blah, blah. He also said it is now. The kingdom of heaven is hence. It's at hand. And then he says, men of violence take it by force. He couldn't come out openly and say, take up the sword, because he knew that, you know, that would get his head chopped off prematurely. But he talked here in seemingly figurative speech. But guys, notice, though, by saying the kingdom of heaven is nigh at hand, and then saying, men of violence, take it by force. The impression could easily have been gotten, and I'm sure he intended that impression to be gotten, that, yeah, we're going to rise up and take it by force. This is the time now. After all, most people in the first century understood that the Messiah would be one who would do just that, right? That he would rise up militarily and bring Israel to glory. Set them free from Roman rule and set up the kingdom of Israel once again like the old glory days of Moses. This is what Jesus was calling for, God damn it.
Oh, but didn't he say my kingdom isn't of this world?
He said a lot of things that contradicted other things he said, didn't he? If he even said them, who knows? Who knows what he did and didn't say? But one thing's for sure, these statements here that reek of rising up, you can bet he said that because all the messianic claimants of the first century made statements like that. Of course, this is right in line with their thinking. Like I said, the few statements where he seems to be all about peace, he either said them for window dressing purposes so he wouldn't look like the rebel that he was and wouldn't be prematurely captured and executed, or they simply were later attributed to him to temper things down so Bible dupes would think that he was a man of peace. Either way, it doesn't matter. The statements advocating violence are still there. You later editors, you idiots, you didn't do a very good job, but I'm glad you didn't. I'm glad you left these statements in there so we could truly see him for what he really was. But as always, look at what Bible dupes do. They ignore statements like this. and they just focus on the gentle Jesus statements. And so the illusion is that, yes, he was all for peace, and they ignore the temper tantrums, the heinous, off-the-wall, hideous statements. They pick and choose, pick and choose. They claim you got to follow all of it, but they don't. They downright ignore and neglect a great deal of it. Anyway, though Christ has been titled both in the New Testament and other Christian sources as the Prince of Peace, these passages and others like them that we'll be looking at later on clearly indicate that he was not interested in peace, except perhaps the exclusive peace of his chosen one. To them, guys, peace meant then, always has, and still to this day, means absence of all opposition. That's what peace means. The meaning of the words that they use is always different from what the public thinks it is. Always different. Some believe that Christ was far superior to the God of the Old Testament, since the Old Testament God was harsh, vengeful, and fearful, while Jesus is seemingly portrayed as being benevolent, meek, and more loving. Yet Christ himself said that he is exactly like the God of the Old Testament. For example, in John 10:30, Jesus said, "I and my Father are one." His Dada was Yahweh, ladies and gentlemen. John 14:9, he said, "He that hath seen me hath seen the Father." With this in mind, look at what the Father said in the following passages. Proverbs 1:26-30 has Yahweh saying, "I also will laugh at your calamity. I will mock when your fear comes. When your fear comes as desolation, and your destruction comes as a whirlwind, when distress and anguish come upon you, then shall they call upon me, but I will not answer. They shall seek me early, but they shall not find me, for that they hated knowledge and did not choose the fear of the Lord. They would not heed to any of my counsel. They despised all my reproof." The psychopathic Yahweh says, "I will laugh at your calamity." Jesus says, "I and my daddy are one." Here's another one. This is Jeremiah 51:20-23. "You, Israel," says the great Yah, "are my battle axe and my sword. With you," excuse me, I always come in twos, "with you, I will shatter nations and destroy many kingdoms. With you, I will shatter armies, destroying the horse and the rider and the chariot and the charioteer. With you, I will shatter men and women, old people and children, young men and maidens. With you, I will shatter shepherds and flocks, farmers and oxen, captains and rulers." What did Jesus say about this psychopathic deity? "I and my Dada are one." We are one and the same. What say you, Christian dupes, about that? Here's a few more. Ezekiel 9:5-7 says, "Then I heard the Lord say to the other men, follow him through the city and kill everyone whose forehead is not marked. Show no mercy, have no pity. Kill them all, old and young, girls and women, little children," says the great Yah. "But do not touch anyone with the mark. Begin your task right here at the temple." So they began by killing the 70 leaders defile the temple, the Lord commanded. Fill its courtyards with bodies of those you kill. Go. So they went throughout the city and did as they were told. Look at this, guys. Look at this horse crap. The great Jesus was all for this. Kill, kill, kill. Little children, the last two passages we just read specifically mentioned little children. The great Yahya, Jesus' daddy, who he said he was exactly like, commanded the murder of little freaking children. How gentle is your Jesus now? Leviticus 26, 21 and 22 is the last one we'll look at. If even then you remain hostile toward me and refuse to obey, I inflict you with seven more disasters for your sins. I will release wild animals that will kill your children and destroy your cattle. So your numbers will dwindle and your roads will be deserted. Praise Yahya. Are you starting to understand the kind of mentality that Jesus had? Can we finally, once and for all, put to rest, put to bed, the idea that Jesus was a great moral leader, a loving and compassionate, humble and meek? Are you frickin' kidding me? Since Christ, by his own testimony, is the spitting image of this deity, which he called his Dada, wouldn't it follow that this is what he's like himself? Many Christians seem to be unaware or in denial that Christ himself is portrayed as a vengeful and wrathful monstrosity in the New Testament, just like his father was in the Old Testament. Oh, yes, he is. Let's take a look. For example, this is Revelation chapter 19. Verses 11 to 21. Listen to the great Jesus. This is not the Old Testament. This is the New. You have any doubt that Jesus is the same tyrannical monster that Yahweh is? We don't just have to go by inference that because his father was a tyrant and he says he and his father are one. We don't just have to go by inference. We can read directly from the New Testament to see what a tyrannical bastard he really is. Here it is, Revelation 19. Starting with verse 11, John says, "And I saw heaven opened, and behold, a white horse, and he," meaning Christ, "he that sat upon him was called Faithful and True, and in righteousness he doth judge and make war." He makes war. But notice it says, oh, it's in righteousness. He makes war in righteousness. He kills little babies in righteousness, so that makes it okay. Try that before a judge. Oh, judge, I went on a shooting spree and killed all those people in righteousness. Oh, why did you say so? Okay. Why is it okay when that little line is thrown in there? Because the Yahya commands it. It's okay. Yahweh commanded rape. Take the young virgins for your booty. That's okay too, because Yahweh said so. Rape is an abominable, despicable act, but because Yahweh commanded it, well, that's no problem. In fact, you'd be a sinner if you didn't obey Yahweh and rape when he told you to rape. You'd be a sinner if you didn't kill little babies when he told you to kill little babies. Some Bible do, in fact, most Bible do. I venture to say probably all Bible do. Would say that what I'm saying right now is over the top. No, it's not. This is what your goddamn book teaches. Oh, God wouldn't do that. It's there. Isn't it amazing, guys? You can show them this stuff. I shouldn't say all Bible do. No. There are, in fact, I know some. I know some Bible believers that do have a problem with passages like the ones we're citing. Amazingly, though, that's not enough for them to see that the whole damn thing is crap. Throw it in the scrap heap. We've been duped. No. They still want to cling to it somehow. You know, it's pretty sad. But they'll say that those passages don't belong in there. They were later added in. Well, but then how can you call this the word of, quote, God then? Thinking that, you know, a loving God is behind this book. How can you do that? This book promises that God will preserve his word till the end. So what you're saying is he wasn't true to his promise. He didn't preserve his word because he's allowed it to be infiltrated and corrupted with all kinds of, come on, man. It's crap. God damn it. Can we finally admit it and stop playing games? Does it suck to lose your religion? Does it suck to find out it's a goddamn fraud? Yes, it does. I can tell you firsthand it does. I had to go through that bitter moment myself. But when you want to be honest with your own goddamn self, let alone other people, when you want to, you know, follow the truth and not be led like a horse with a bit in its mouth, you have to come to the point where you finally admit, yeah, I've been suckered with that too. How can you progress forward when you're still clinging to something that deep down inside you've got to know is bullcrap? Anyway, the passage continues, Revelation 19. His eyes, meaning Jesus now, his eyes were as a flame of fire, and on his head were many crowns, and he had a name written that no man knew but he himself. And he was clothed with a vesture dipped in blood. Oh, that's nice. This is the great Jesus, guys. And his name is called the Word of God. And the armies which were in heaven followed him upon white horses, clothed in fine linen, white and clean. Oh, yeah, blah, 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 blah. And out of his mouth goes a sharp sword, that with it he should smite the nations, and he shall rule them with a rod of iron. And he treads the winepress of the fierceness and wrath of Almighty God. Jesus is going to come with the fierceness and wrath. Wrath isn't something you can have. It's naughty. It's a sin. And it's going to keep you out of heaven. But Yahweh can be wrathful. And he can be fierce too. And he hath on his vesture and on his thigh a name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Oh, gee, I thought that's what the Pope was. And I saw an angel standing in the sun, and he cried with a loud voice, saying to all the fowls that fly in the midst of heaven, come and gather yourselves together unto the supper of the great God, that you may eat the flesh of kings and the flesh of captains and the flesh of mighty men and the flesh of horses and them that sit on them and the flesh of all men, both free and bond. Listen to how hideous this is. Both small and great. A call from heaven goes out to birds of prey, you know, eagles, vultures, whatever. Go and eat the flesh of all of these men. Oh, this is real nice imagery, isn't it? This is the great and gentle Jesus. And I saw the beast and the kings of the earth and their armies gathered together to make war against him that sat on the horse and against his army. And the beast was taken, and with him the false prophet that wrought miracles before him, with which he deceived them that had received the mark of the beast, and them that worshipped his image. These both were cast alive into the lake of fire, burning with brimstone. And both, and the remnant were slain with the sword of him that sat upon the horse. That means Jesus. The ones that weren't burned in the fire, Jesus slayed them with the sword, which proceeded out of his mouth, and all the fowls were filled with their flesh. All the fowls, you know, the birds of prey that swoop down to eat their flesh, they were all filled with their flesh. Listen to how disgusting, how grotesque, how hideous this scene is. The great Jesus, if he was so loving and yet felt the need to wipe out all of these bad guys here, who, when you come right down to it, were set up to be bad, right? You know, if you go back to the Garden of Eden, he's the bastard who put the frickin' tree there. Don't eat from it, but here it is right in front of you to be tempted. I'm even going to have this devil character disguised as a beautiful serpent. At that time, serpents were attractive. That's, you know, the most subtle, it says. That, you know, that's what we're supposed to believe anyway. So, you know, the devil chose a subtle, beautiful creature at the time. Later, after sin, we're told, the serpent was cursed and made to look ugly and became a symbol of evil. But supposedly at that time, you know, Lucifer, the fallen angel, chose the most beautiful of creatures. So Eve was tempted, we're told, by a beautiful, subtle creature, a harmless creature. Yahweh, in other words, let this whole thing get dressed up, you know, as pretty as could be, to be most attractive, to lure Eve in. She was set up. This is goddamn entrapment. I can't stress it enough. So we're supposed to believe that all the thousands and thousands of years of human suffering, rapes and murders, thefts and disease and death and suffering and misery, all of it resulted because this psychopathic, sadistic bastard put a tree in the middle of the garden. Don't touch it. Whatever you do now, don't go near it. Don't even look at it. But, oh, doesn't it look tasty? But don't go near it, damn it. And then he sends this beautiful creature to come and tempt Eve. God damn it, Eve. Your God's lying to you. Look. I'm eating this thing. It's not hurting me, Eddie. Can't you see? Didn't he say the day you would eat it, you would die? I've been here for weeks eating this stuff. Look at me. I'm fine. The great Yah allowed that kind of temptation. That's entrapment, no matter how you get around it. Of course, this story is a goddamn fairy tale, but it doesn't matter. Bible dupes take it literal. Okay, let's pretend it's literal. That makes your God a psychopathic bastard, doesn't it? Of course it does. A sadistic, twisted little fricktard. And you worship that thing? Him and his little junior that command the murder of little babies. How can you possibly doubt? We haven't even gotten into the heart of this discussion yet. But already, how could you have any doubt that Jesus was an insurrectionist when you look at the kind of sick and twisted philosophy he embraced? He upheld Moses. He upheld Isaiah. Look at the stuff they wrote. Look at the psychopathic actions attributed to them, whether you believe they actually happen or not. It doesn't matter. Their kind of mentality is what Jesus embraced. And you're going to tell me you don't think he was an insurrectionist? How could he not have been? That was right up his alley. Do understand, guys, all of these insurrectionist groups, the Essenes, the Zealots, the Sicariot, they all wanted the restoration of the glory days of Moses, just like Jesus. They all sought the same thing. They were all fed up with the hypocrisy of the Pharisees. Christians think that that's what makes Jesus so great, is he wanted to bring back the glory days of Moses. That's what made him so evil, you mindless asses. If you're still not convinced that something is wrong with the character of Christ here, as portrayed in, you know, churches and in some of the New Testament, take a look at this gem. In Matthew 15, 22 to 28, Jesus showed his true Jewish supremacist colors when he said, or when we read, "And behold, a woman of Canaan, a Gentile, came out of the same coasts and cried unto him, saying, Have mercy on me, O Lord, thou son of David. My daughter is grievously vexed with the devil. But he answered her not a word. He didn't say anything. Here she is coming to him, pleading with him, not for her own sake, but for her daughter's sake. He wouldn't answer her. He's ignoring her. And his disciples came and besought him, saying, Send her away, for she crieth after us. Here were the disciples, just like modern day disciples of this nutbag. They don't care, guys.
Oh, she's a Gentile.
Oh, they might not say it for those reasons, but they'll say, Oh, that person's a heathen, or that person doesn't like Jesus, or is against Christianity. To hell with them, let them suffer. That's their attitude today, just as Jesus' disciples had that attitude then. But then Jesus answered and said, I am not sent but to the lost house, the lost sheep of the house of Israel. He made that same comment in this context. I am only sent to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. That was his response to this Gentile woman coming to him and asking him selflessly for a favor for her daughter, not for herself. She wasn't asking that she be healed. She was asking that her daughter, a little girl, be healed. What was Jesus' response?
I didn't come for you, goddamn Gentiles. I came for you.
That was Jesus' response. Then she came and worshipped him. She kissed his ass, saying, Lord, help me. But he answered and said, It is not meet to take the children's bread and to cast it to the dogs. Still, she was bowing to him, kissing his ass. And his response was, No, it's not meet to take the children's meat and give it to the dogs. He's calling her a dog. But then she said, True, Lord. Yet the dogs eat of the crumbs which fall from the master's table. Ah! Then Jesus answered and said unto her, O woman, great is your faith. You went above and beyond merely just kissing my ass. You admitted that you're a dog, and you admitted that you'll be willing to at least take some crumbs as long as you kiss my ass and bow before me and admit that my tribe is superior to you. Since you're willing to admit that, be it done unto thee, even as thou wilt. Ordinarily, I wasn't going to heal your daughter because I don't give a damn about you or your daughter. You're just goyim scum. But because you kissed my ass adequately enough and acknowledged that my tribe is superior to you, be it done unto you. And her daughter was made whole from that very hour. Tell me, damn it, that this isn't a scoundrelous swine bag Jewish supremacist talking here. Tell me. You won't even try to do it. I dare you. I challenge you. Call me in and defend your great Jesus. Tell me how wonderful he is when he made statements like this, you mindless asses. I hear crickets chirping. Right now, guys, if there's any Christian listening, their blood is boiling with anger and hatred. They taste my blood on their lips. They're shouting curses at me because they're just such loving people. Short break. Be right back.
Now, let's hear from a Jewish academic.
My concern is doing away with whiteness. Whiteness is a form of racial oppression. Sure. The suggestion is that it is somehow possible to separate whiteness from oppression. and it is not. There can be no white race without the phenomenon of white supremacists. In the same way, if you abolish racial oppression, you do away with whiteness. Treason to whiteness is loyalty to humanity.
Your views are fairly well received in academia.
Yes, they're legitimate. Not to say that everyone agrees, but sure. And the task is to bring this minority together in such a way that it makes it impossible for the legacy of whiteness to continue to reproduce itself.
Guys, welcome back. Already in our final segment here. You know, if you feel you got to worship something, some people just, they have that deep inner need. Worship the goddamn telephone pole outside your window there. It's far less lethal. You can't get into too much trouble with that. The telephone pole isn't commanding you to kill little babies, isn't requiring you to cling to ridiculous beliefs and become a hypocrite and judge other people. You know, but this thing, this monstrosity, Jesus was constantly cutting down Gentiles and exalting his tribe. Here's another example, Matthew 6, 31 and 32. Therefore, take no thought, saying, what shall we eat, or what shall we drink, or with what shall we be clothed? For after these things do the Gentiles seek. In other words, the Gentiles worry about such trivial things. But you, my chosen ones, you don't. Because you know your Heavenly Father provides for you. Oh, yeah, he provides for them, all right. How does he provide for them? They steal everything. And this book endorses that. Thou shalt charge usury to the Gentile, but not to thy fellow Jew. It endorses stealing. I gave them this land. How did he give it to them? He told them to go to war and steal it. That's how. But look again how he's cutting down the Gentile and exalting his tribe. Here's yet another example. In John 4:22, Jesus said to the Samaritan woman at the well, you don't know what you're worshiping. We Jews know what we worship because salvation comes from the Jews. Look at how many exaltative statements he made about his tribe. Cut down Gentiles, exalted his tribe.
You Gentiles don't know what you worship, but we know what we worship.
For salvation is of the Jews. Can you get any more arrogant than that? Look how many statements he made along this line. Why would he send such a mixed message unless he did indeed view his tribe as superior to Gentiles? Of course he did. I came only for the lost sheep of the house. God damn it, man. All the other messianic claimants of the first century had that mentality. And you Bible dupes want us to think that Jesus was an exception? He made these statements. Matthew 10, verses 5 and 6 say, these 12, the 12 disciples, Jesus sent forth and commanded them, saying, go not into the way of the Gentiles, and into any city of the Samaritans enter ye not, but go rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Who did Jesus, when he sent them out on their first missionary journey, who did he send them out to? Who did he tell them to go and minister to? He sent them out to minister to tribe members, didn't he? Not to Gentiles. He specifically told them not to go to any Gentiles, only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Confirming what he said, I came only for the lost sheep of the house of Israel. That's all he came for. That's all Christianity was, guys, in its earliest days, was a Jewish branch religion. You can see that in the book of Acts, where Paul is battling it out with them. He wanted to Gentilize it. They didn't want that. There was a huge rift, a huge split. They were adamantly opposed to one another, the Paul crowd and the James crowd. Luke 24:47 says, "And that repentance and remission of sins," said Jesus, "should be preached in his name among all nations, beginning at Jerusalem." That was his priority. Anyway, let's move on here. Paul confirmed this when he said, "Now I say that Jesus Christ was a minister of the circumcision," meaning the Jews, "for the truth of God, to confirm the promises made unto the fathers," Romans 15:8. So this was Jesus's priority, but he knew ultimately that if this plan didn't succeed, they would have to turn to the Gentiles. They would have to convert this religion into a Gentile one if it didn't work. So that's why he said, beginning first at Jerusalem. We might have to go and spread this message elsewhere and recruit Gentiles, but let's begin in Jerusalem first. We're going to focus here first, because if we can rally enough Jews behind us and get the Pharisees on our side, we can overthrow Rome. We don't need help from the Goyim. It was never intended that this religion reach out to the Goyim. Never. That's, you know, they didn't want that. They realized we might have to do it reluctantly, you know, if things don't work out. Paul himself stated, though, that Jews were a priority. For example, in Romans 1:16, he said, "For I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God unto salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jews first and also to the Greek." Jews first. Romans 3 verses 1 and 2. "What advantage then is there in being a Jew, or what value is there in circumcision? Much in every way," he says. First of all, the Jews have been entrusted with the very words of God. "Much in every way," he said, "there is an advantage. We are superior." Can you imagine? Oh, Christians will point to other passages where Paul says, "We're all one in Christ. There's no Jew. There's no Greek." But then he turns around and makes these comments. Do you see how, again, they pick and choose? They like the passages where Paul says, "There's no Jew. There's no Greek." You know, they like that because that makes it look like, see, there's none. There isn't one that's better than the other. But Paul also made these statements, didn't he? First to the Jew, then to the Greek. "Much in every way, there's an advantage to." Those aren't statements of equality. Again, a schizophrenic book with a schizophrenic message, and the schizophrenic Christians usually only pick the parts that they like and ignore the rest. But anyway, back to the great Jesus. John 1:47 says, "Jesus saw Nathanael coming to him and said of him, 'Ah, behold, an Israelite indeed, in whom there is no deceit.'" Whoa! That went way off the charts there, didn't it, folks? According to Jesus, a true Israelite is one in whom there is no deceit. Oh, and isn't that true? I mean, just look at the goddamn media, right? They own it all. No deceit there. Guys, they've been this way from freaking day one. They've always been the masters of proper freaking ganda. And here's Jesus saying, Holy Christ, you got to be kidding me. And there's nothing holy about Christ, believe me. Even the book of Revelation, a scene of Jewish supremacism is painted for us, as we are told that one day in heaven, we shall all live with Christ in New Jerusalem, and that this city will be surrounded by a wall with 12 gates, each containing one of the names of the 12 tribes of Israel. So we're told that heaven is going to be Jewland, aren't we? We're told in the Old Testament that we're going to lick Jew feet into endless perpetuity.
I will bring all nations before you. They will bow before you and lick
the dust from the soles of your feet. No wonder Jesus said, Jerusalem shall be trampled underfoot by the Gentiles until the time of the Gentiles will be fulfilled. And what will happen when the time of the Gentiles is fulfilled? They're all going to lick Jew feet. That's what Jesus was looking forward to, like all the insurrectionists of his era. Anyway, what's been said thus far should more than suffice enough to prove that Jesus was, in fact, not only a Jew, but a Jewish supremacist. Nevertheless, there's many out there who deny this fact, claiming that he wasn't a frickin' tribe member. Because of this, let's elaborate for a moment on his Jewishness, shall we? The very first verse of the New Testament talks about, quote, the book of the genealogy of Jesus, the son of David, the son of Abraham, Matthew 1:1. In Romans 1:3, Paul further states, concerning his son, Jesus Christ, our Lord, which was made of the seed of David according to the flesh. He was the son of David according to the flesh. What does that mean? It means genetically in the modern vernacular. He was the son of David, not just because he followed the Jewish religion. No, he was genetically a Jew. You know, there are Christian dupes out there who claim to be Jew-wise, who claim that Jesus wasn't a Oh, my God. Really now? Any other fantasies, fairy tales you'd like to share with us? In John 1, verse 11, John says that the Jews were Christ's own, meaning own kind. He wrote, he, Christ, came into his own, the Jews. And his own received him not. The Jews were his own. Of course they were. He loved his own, didn't he? I came only. He called the Gentile woman a dog. As we'll see later, Jesus accepted the title King of the Jews because he applied it to himself. In Luke 2:21, we find that Jesus was circumcised on the eighth day according to ancient Jewish tradition. According to Luke 2:22 and 23, he was dedicated in the temple, again, according to the law of Moses. He is called the consolation of Israel in Luke 2:25 and the glory of thy people Israel in Luke 2:32. According to Luke 2:41, Jesus, along with his parents, went to Jerusalem for the Passover feast. Luke 2:46 tells us that upon one of these visits at the age of 12, Christ remained behind to discuss the law of Moses with the Pharisees in the temple. He continued to attend the Passover feast as an adult, according to John 2:13, John 5:1, John 6:4, and John 19:14. He called the temple my father's house in Luke 2:49. His dada was Yahweh, to whom the temple was dedicated. Hello? Again? Anybody home? Hello? How in the world do you think you can possibly get away with saying he wasn't a freaking tribe member? Jesus was called Rabbi. In John 4:31, and he constantly taught from, quoted from, and upheld, quote, the scriptures. What the hell do you think he was talking about when he referred to the scripture? He's talking about the old goddamn Testament. A Samaritan woman recognized him as a Jew, according to John 4:9. It was his custom to go to the synagogue every Sabbath, according to Luke 4:16. In fact, on this occasion, he read from the Isaiah scroll in the synagogue, as we saw earlier. Anyway, he also attended the Feast of Tabernacles, according to John 7:2-14. He also attended the Feast of Dedication on Hanukkah, according to John 10:22. He apparently observed all the tribal festivals. Refer to John 5:11, where we have that indicated. As stated, he told the Samaritan woman that we Jews know what we worship. Come on, folks. Can it get any clearer than this? There's even more evidence than this, but quite frankly, need any more be said on the matter? Christians are quick to point out how Christ hated the corrupt teachings of the Pharisees, as I said. And no doubt this is true. For example, in Matthew 7:13, Christ said to them, "You make the word of God of none effect through your traditions." So this is why one of the reasons why Christians praise him. Oh, he was against the Talmudic traditions. But what did he want to replace it with? The goddamn Torah. What the hell is the difference? Oh, the Talmud might be more openly, brazenly evil. But you know what? That makes the Torah actually more evil, because when you cloak something evil with a more subtle garb, that makes it more dangerous, doesn't it? Actually, there's nothing subtle about the Old Testament. It's openly evil. But yeah, if you read the Talmud and compare it side by side, the Talmud has it is more brazenly evil. But you know, like I always say, guys, what does it matter? Crap comes in all different hues. There's brown crap. There's black crap. Crap sometimes can have a greenish hue. It can even have a yellowish tint to it, but it's still crap, isn't it? Christians take pride, though, in claiming that Christ was trying to lead the Pharisees away from their corrupt Talmudic-like traditions and back to the pure Old Testament. But in light of passages like the ones we've just looked at, isn't it clear, guys, that the Old Testament is not pure? It's corrupt as well. All that Christ wanted to do, once again, just like the other rabble-rousers of his day, is replace one filthy form of religion with another one. That's all. He wanted to win the Jerusalem leaders back over to his way of thinking and to join in the fray of rebellion against Rome. That's all it was. When the leaders of Israel of Jerusalem couldn't be won over, all the rebels, including Jesus, blamed them for the fate that Israel suffered in 70 AD when the Romans attacked Jerusalem. But the truth is, guys, the Romans attacked Jerusalem because of the rebels like Jesus, not because of the scribes and Pharisees. They blamed it on them. It's your rebellion against the Torah that we're being invaded. No, it's your rebel rousing, goddammit, that brought it about. You see how they work? The whole chapter of Matthew 23 contains one rebuke of Christ after another against the scribes and Pharisees. And sure enough, Josephus, initially one of the rebels himself, assisting with the uprisings against Rome, condemned the Jewish leaders as being responsible for the Roman sacking of Jerusalem, when it was he and his fellow rebel rousers once again that were responsible. But notice what he said in the following quote, which sounds so reminiscent of what Christ said. This is Josephus, guys. The man who, as I pointed out last week, apparently was the Apostle Paul, or at least hijacked Paul's identity. He certainly was totally in league with Paul, went to school the same time Paul did. And if they were, in fact, two separate individuals, the least you could say is that they were working in conjunction with one another to advance this new Gentilized branch of Judaism called Christianity to suit their needs, to suit their interests, to rally Gentiles behind them in their cause. They needed numbers, right? But anyway, look what he said here. So in line with what Jesus said. Oh, most wretched city. Oh, my God. We could stop right there. Jesus in Matthew 23 cried over Jerusalem. Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem. How often did I desire to take you under my wings like a mother hen takes her chicks, but you would have no part of me. Behold, your house is left unto you desolate. This is exactly what Josephus is saying here. O most wretched city, what misery so great is this? Did you suffer from the Romans when they came to purify you from your intestine or intestinal hatred? He's blaming the scribes and Pharisees for what he and his fellow rebels incited. Jesus was doing the same goddamn thing, guys. He said, you know, that you will be decimated, your house will be left desolate because of your rebellion. Rebellion against what? Against his rebellious cause. Against not returning to the good old days of Moses and the Torah. Jesus was not the good guy in this contention. He was the bad guy, God damn it. You know, not that the scribes and Pharisees were anything to side with either, but you understand my point. As far as, you know, the land of Israel went at this time, the scribes and Pharisees were doing what was right, not the great Jesus. Their so-called compromising with Rome only made sense, right? What Jesus was doing was rebel-rousing. He's being an antagonistic little bastard, just like all the other frickin' messianic claimants of the first century. And then blaming them, saying that the Romans are going to come in and sack you because you're rebellious against Yahya. The Romans came in and sacked Jerusalem because of people like Jesus who incited them to do so. Josephus goes on to say, for you could no longer be a place fit for God. No. Again, you weren't fit for God because you didn't rise up like Moses did. Nor could you long continue in being after you had been a sepulcher for the bodies of your own people and had made the holy house itself a burning place in this civil war of yours. Whose civil war was it? Yet may you again grow better if perchance you will hereafter appease the anger of that God who is the author of your destruction. Guys, you couldn't get any more in line with the great Jesus here than this. Josephus was speaking the exact same words, pretty much, that Jesus spoke in Matthew 23. You can't miss it. Jesus was in line with Josephus, a.k.a. frickin' Paul, if you ask me. But he was in line with all the rebel rousers, making the scribes and Pharisees out to look like they were the problem. You brought this on yourselves. They executed these rebels for bringing stuff like that on, right? Ultimately, though, they succeeded. They got the Romans to come in. They couldn't execute them fast enough. Every time they would kill a few of them, dozens more rose up. They'd go after those dozens and hundreds more rose up. They'd go after those hundreds and thousands more would rise up. The rebel cause spread like wildfire. The Pharisees, the scribes, couldn't keep it in check any longer. It got so out of hand, Rome had to step in. And then these bastards had the gall to blame them? That's what Jesus did, and that's what Josephus did. You just heard it right here. Go read Matthew 23 in conjunction with this quote I just read from Josephus. Holy Christ, it's the same goddamn statement, guys. you know, the verbiage is a little different, but the meaning is the same. It's exactly the same. Whose side was the great Jesus on, Bible dupes? He played the same game all the terrorists played that came from Galilee. Well, no wonder. Where did Jesus recruit his disciples from? From Galilee. Guys, I haven't even gotten started yet. I'm not even halfway through this current set of notes. Then I have another whole set of notes on this same topic from a slightly different angle. And then I've got another shorter set of notes after that where I'm going to cover this same thing from a different angle. But already with what we've covered, there's no getting around it. There's no weaseling your way out. Jesus was a first century insurrectionist, goddammit, a zealot, a rebel, a terrorist. For Christ's sakes, would you open your goddamn eyes once and for all and see this for what it is and stop living in Mr. Rogers' land of frickin' make-believe? No wonder churches love bells so much. I think it's to mimic Mr. Rogers' little trolley. Ding, 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 ding. Jesus Christ, man. It's the land of freaking make-believe. No truth to any of it. The reality of what it really originally once was is the very opposite of what you think it is. I've yet to do my show on early Christian sects. I got to cover that sometime. Where do you see the outrageous confusion right from the word go? It's not just that, you know, centuries later, long after the original founders of the religion had died and confusion arose and a bunch of different sects, came about. No, no, no. It was that way from the word go, guys. I will just look at the division with Paul and James right there. It was all downhill after that. All right, guys. Lots more to say about this.
Greetings, Renegade listener. Have you been enjoying the show? Well, then why don't you share it with your friends and family? Click on the show page and then find the social media links right under the description. Or send out a message to an email list. Get the word out however you can. Don't be afraid of letting other people know that you listen to Renegade Broadcasting. You'd be surprised how many of them agree with what we're saying here. With your help, we'll be destroying the mass media's narrative in no time at all. Let's wake up the world, one share at a time.